Good afternoon. This is Richmond Independent Radio News for Friday, April 22nd. I'm George Goodrich. This week, WRIR reporters visit the Richmond Fire Training Academy and take an economic look at the proposed Shaco Bottom Baseball Stadium.
Taxpayers are going to pay about $40 to $50 million for this stadium.
On this day in 1875, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Ellen Glasgow was born in Richmond. On April 23, 1951, students at the all-black Morton High School in Prince Edward County staged a walkout and two-week strike to protest the conditions at their school. The resulting lawsuit became part of the Supreme Court ruling that made school segregation illegal in 1954. Now the news.
For WRIR News, I'm Andrew Large. On April 15th, while some Richmonders struggled to complete their income taxes, others celebrated the birth of a new voice in Richmond media, RVA Magazine. WRIR's Nancy Lee reports.
RVA's glossy monthly publication geared toward the abundant young professional and youth cultures in the metro area. The magazine touts itself as the latest accessory for With It Richmonders. Publisher Anthony Harris created the magazine to be a forum for local writing and artwork, and to generally support independent arts in Richmond. Harris says he has been overwhelmed by community support and believes he can succeed in a market where other similar magazines have failed.
The reason why Two and Punchline definitely had their problems was relying on businesses to see the potential of an underground culture type of magazine. Like a lot of businesses don't want to put their money into that, but if you rely on a for-pay magazine, I'm relying more on the individual people that live in the city to support me and then the advertising to come after that.
The sleek pocket-sized magazine can be found for $5 at Plan 9 Records and Chop Suey Books. For WRIR News, I'm Nancy Lee in Jackson Ward.
To some, it may be shocking. To others, a beautiful tribute. But to P.J. Shea and his fiancée, Marie Hawks, their wedding day is just an extension of their own unique love. WRIR's Mike Doolin has more.
At a controversial time when religious heads and political moralists debate over the sanctity of marriage, the boundaries that must encompass it, and those that should be allowed to participate, one Richmond couple has decided to step outside of such ritualistic circles. In the true spirit of showmanship and abandoned conformity, this couple has chosen instead to celebrate their wedding day on April 23rd at the Bird Theater in a most unique fashion. P.J. Shea is the groom and helped mastermind the ceremony.
You get to see me, my fiancé, tie the knot. You get to see Elvis, R2-D2. You also get to watch the incredible 1934 Oscar-winning film You Can't Take It With You, directed by Frank Capra and starring Jimmy Stewart and Lionel Barrymore.
With many more surprises in store, PJ says the wedding is a chance for them to give back to those that have given them so much joy. The cost of such a fun-filled event is $5. The wedding begins at 2 p.m., and all proceeds go to the Bird Theater Foundation. For WRIR, I'm Mike Doolin in Carytown.
A Richmond-based National Guard unit has been placed on alert for possible mobilization. About 400 members of the 2nd Battalion's 224th Aviation Unit received the alert last weekend. Lieutenant Colonel Chester Carter of the Virginia National Guard says the alert only means the unit should prepare for possible deployment.
If unit members have personal issues that they need to deal with, and that could be a whole host of things ranging from bank accounts to powers of attorney, families affected by the alert should take care of those types of things. The unit leadership will be dealing with issues like ensuring that the unit is fully staffed, fully equipped, that all training requirements both at the individual and at the unit level have been addressed.
The unit is based at Richmond International Airport and flies about 30 Black Hawk helicopters, which are used for transporting cargo and personnel. The 224th has not been deployed to Iraq or Afghanistan since the start of the Second Gulf War. One company of the unit was deployed to Bosnia in 2002. On April 14th, Richmond's 4th Federal Appeals Court ruled that Chesterfield County's Board of Supervisors could block a witch from giving the invocation at board meetings. WRIR's Aaron Hickey reports.
In 2002, Cindy Simpson attempted to be added to the list of clergy eligible to perform invocation at the County Board of Supervisors meetings. Initially, The courts found in favor of Simpson, but last week, the federal appeals court overturned that ruling. Simpson, a self-identified witch and pagan, would like to perform non-sectarian blessings that would not mention God or any other deity. For example, if she were to give an invocation today, she says she'd discuss rebirth, regrowth, and balance. These topics are related to the pagan holiday, spring equinox. Similar themes are also associated with the Christian holiday, Easter. Simpson says she wants to be included in the proceedings of her local government and does not want to see the invocations eliminated entirely. With the aid of the American Civil Liberties Union and Americans United for the Separation of Church and State, Simpson plans to appeal the most recent ruling in the 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. Judges there will vote on whether or not to hear the case. For WRIR News, I'm Erin Hickey.
Chesterfield County has not returned requests for an interview at the time of this airing. Here's your wacky Richmond weather forecast for the weekend. According to the National Weather Service, this evening, more of the same. Clouds and a 50-50 chance of more showers and thunderstorms. Lows in the upper 50s. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy for breakfast. More sun as the day goes on. Again, 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms. Again, highs in the 70s. Tomorrow night, it should stay cloudy, but prepare for a big drop in temperature. Overnight, we expect lows in the 40s. Sunday. Some sun, but cooler. Highs won't get out of the 50s. And Sunday night, partly cloudy and cold, with lows in the upper 30s. So there's your wacky Richmond weather forecast. But remember, weather predictions are nonlinear equations. This is WRIR News.
For WRIR News, I'm George Goodrich. The Richmond Fire Department maintains 20 firehouses throughout the city, staffed with highly trained firefighters and emergency responders. Last week, they gave a group of Richmond citizens a glimpse at what it's like to do their job, but with a little less danger and perhaps a little more fun. WRIR's Lauren Ball has this report.
Every year, the Richmond Fire Department puts its new recruits through 18 weeks of intensive training exercises at its Fire Training Academy. On April 14th and 15th, a group of ordinary citizens got to suit up and experience what it's like to be a firefighter at that very same facility. The Customer Fire Training Academy is offered free of charge and takes place a few times a year. It is open to anyone over the age of 18 and offers all the thrills and challenges of any extreme sport. It also instills valuable lessons of fire safety and prevention while giving participants an inside look at the perilous and taxing work of a firefighter. Lieutenant Kent Taylor oversees the training academy.
The Custom Academy began about 7 years ago, and it's an opportunity for the citizens of the city of Richmond to find out a little bit more about the Richmond Fire Department. And it's an opportunity for our staff to showcase our enthusiasm and our interest in the community.
So chances are you're going to find that kid underneath the bed in the closet.
On the first day, customers attend a variety of classes designed to introduce the procedures and safety regulations followed by firefighters in the field. They also help protect participants when they eventually graduate to the hands-on training activities. The second day finds the customers donning protective gear and facing firefighting challenges head-on. Lieutenant Keith Vita is the assistant fire marshal for the Richmond Fire Department.
They come out, spend 2 days with us, do rappelling, do hazmat, cut open cars, go through a maze in a smoke building, and kind of give them an idea of what Richmond Fire Department does on a daily basis.
At the Customer Academy, the smoke is theatrical, but the effect is the same as the real thing. Participants are often surprised by the difficulty of navigating through a darkened, smoke-filled structure. Using their newfound knowledge, they conduct searches for simulated people and animals within a burning building. They become familiar with tools used by firefighters, including a handheld thermal imaging camera, which can identify body heat as well as determine the location of the fire itself. Trainees also get the chance to rappel off a 7-story structure, simulating a rescue from a window or roof. This provides a challenge for some and a thrill for others. Liz Woolard, an employee of the Sheriff's Office, found the program exciting.
Yes, it was very challenging, the rappelling down the wall for somebody who's terrified of heights, yes. It's all been great. It has been wonderful, and I hope that they can get the word out more about this because it would be a wonderful experience for everybody.
At the most recent Customer Academy, the majority of participants worked for the City of Richmond. By coming to better understand how the fire department does their job, these city employees say they will be able to work more effectively with firefighters in emergency situations. Cleveland Washington works for the Richmond Redevelopment and Housing Authority and thinks that a knowledge of firefighting tactics and fire safety will be useful in his work.
We work on a lot of developments and things like that, and if a fire should occur before the firemen get there, then we would know what to do to go into the unit, maybe save somebody's life.
At the end of the two-day academy, there is an award ceremony where individuals and teams win prizes for outstanding performance. Every participant also goes home with a shirt and a hat commemorating their 2 days with the Richmond Fire Department. The department itself hopes that the experience will have a lasting effect on how their customers view fire safety and give them a better appreciation of the skills that Richmond firefighters take to work every day. They invite any and all citizens of Richmond to join them out on the training grounds. For WRIR, I'm Lauren Ball at the Richmond Fire Training Academy.
WRIR is always looking for input from the community, and the news department is no different. This week, Nancy Lee and Clyde Hott are talking to strangers.
I'm Nancy Lee.
And I'm Clyde Hott.
And we're talking to strangers.
This week, we decided to visit the Diamond for opening day.
And see what our Braves fans had to say about the new proposed Shaco Bottom Stadium.
Glenn Eastman. I just can't get too excited about it. I've been coming here since I was a kid, sitting watching the Richmond V's, and I've always liked it right here.
Thomas Gaskins. They don't build a new stadium, this team's gone. This place is older than me. It's a dump. This is the only major or minor league team we have that's worth a snot in this town, and we're going to lose them if the city doesn't get off its butt and do something.
Jeff Brown. This is a pretty nice stadium, and I can't see abandoning this and moving downtown or being held hostage by the Atlanta Braves organization.
Dick Spicer. If they can get the drainage work taken care of, I absolutely think they need to do it. I think the spot between Federal Reserve and Ethel with a good view of the river was really a great place, but I guess it just wasn't enough room. At any rate, I'm all for it, $360, $330 million for the city of Richmond. I think it's got to happen.
Evan Chesterman. Should remain exactly where it is, because it's already here. It's in a great location. It's easy to get to. There's plenty of parking. And the people who come to baseball games don't care whether there are bars and restaurants around.
So would you feel that you would go to games down in Shaco Bottom?
Oh, yeah, I probably would go, sure, because I like to go to the baseball games.
My name is Steve Johnson. Well, actually, I think it'll be a good idea because it'll bring more revenue to the Shaco Bottom area as well as attracting more fans. And if they bring in more parking, you know, it'll be a great idea because it's more to do down there. It's like right now where it is, it's away from everything. If you got people coming into Richmond staying downtown, you know, they come to a game, they can go right downtown, you know, and see everything.
Jack, this is a nice place here. It's easy on, easy off. We'll go to Norfolk and see a game before we go to Shaco Bottom. I don't want to get shot.
William Elmore. This is a perfect place. Right here, it's close to the Boulevard, Interstate 95 and 64, easy access. Down there, it's going to be terrible. I worked in there for 20 years. I know what it's like. I'm a season ticket holder and have been for 10 years, and I will not go down there.
Irma Fazuski.
Well, I'm not so sure if I like the necessary location of the Shaco Bottom, but I do think we need a new stadium or some major improvements on this one. I'd probably go to games anywhere they had them, but I would go to Shaco Bottom if their games were there.
Nancy Lee and Clyde Hott talked to 31 Braves fans and found they were evenly split between supporters and opponents of the new Shaco Bottom Stadium. The stadium proposal has been hotly contested from City Hall to the Diamond for almost 18 months, with both sides predicting the economic doom of Richmond with or without the ballpark. WRIR's Mike Doolin and Nancy Lee visited University of Richmond professor Jonathan White to get a lesson on the economic impact of ballparks.
If there's one thing that keeps coming up over and over and over again is that people expect there to be a free lunch. And the proponents of the baseball stadium keep saying, oh, this baseball stadium is going to be free. And anytime anyone tells you that something is about to be free, then you need to go back to Econ 101. The lesson of Econ 101 is there's no free lunch. And so the citizens of Richmond need to ask themselves, how is the stadium really going to get paid for? And if you look at the way the stadium is going to be paid, it's going to be paid through tax increment financing, which is to say taxpayers are going to pay about $40 to $50 million for this stadium. Tax increment financing asks people who develop near the stadium to pay a special to pay their taxes, and the taxes go to finance the stadium. Well, that's tax money that cannot go to schools, police, fire department, education, and all the other areas. So when economists have analyzed the impact of sports stadiums around America, they have reached pretty much a unanimous conclusion, and these conclusions were published in the Journal of Economic Perspectives in the summer of 2002. And the Journal of Economic Perspectives is one of the top journals in America for economists, very highly respected. We have serious economists asking serious questions about how do sports stadiums affect economic development? And their answer is they do not help economic development generally. In some cases, they even hurt economic development.
How come these studies were begun, initially started off these economic studies?
Well, all over America, communities are asking themselves the same question. Gee, we're scared of losing our ball club, and the ball team is kind of blackmailing us to say with the threat that if you don't build us a new stadium, they're going to leave. So all over America, people have been building stadiums. You know, the government has been involved in helping one way or the other to get stadiums built. But the obvious question is, has that help hurt or hindered economic development? And the answer that all of these, about 100 of these independent studies are finding out is that the money that was spent on these stadiums could have been better spent to promote economic development through better schools, fighting crime, doing basic things like lowering taxes. So I think the results are in uniformly that baseball stadium building or sports stadium building in general is not an engine of economic growth.
Have you ever worked with City Hall or government officials or even the Richmond Braves on any of these studies at all?
Yes, I have, starting about a year ago, made these studies available to the Richmond Braves and their supporters, the proponents of the stadium. And the reply that you get is, first of all, a little bit of stunned silence because they really didn't know the data was out there already. But second, they really don't want to believe the data because no politician ever got elected who wasn't willing to cut ribbons and do this kind of stuff. I mean, Wilder's the one who's come in and said, I'm going to hold people's feet to the fire. Usually politicians want to do lots of programs. They want to cut ribbons. They want to build new stadiums. They want to do whatever they can to get their face in front of the camera. Stadium proponents say, go visit, you know, this city here. Go visit Louisville. Go visit this other city. And you go to visit and you ask the mayor or the city council, has the sports stadium helped development? They're always going to say yes, because to say no would be to admit that we could have done something better. And they never will do that.
There's the Sacred Ground Society, if you're familiar with it. They're more in favor of building somewhat of a memorialized site for the slave burial ground that is, straight looking at it economically, build a memorialized area at the same time these other people trying to put in a $300 million baseball stadium promising money and stuff.
First of all, the so-called $300 million that they're talking about has yet to be seen. When we ask what would produce the biggest bang for the buck for businesses in Richmond, it's not baseball. It really isn't. When we think about heritage tourism and historical tourism, that's a much bigger generator of economic development for the following reason. People come to Richmond to see the Civil War Museum, Tredegar, all the battlefields. They come from all over the United States, and they come from countries all over the world to see that. Nobody comes to Richmond to see a minor league baseball team. They don't. History tourists stay longer and spend more money than just about any other category of tourist who comes to the region. So what do I think about the slave cemetery? That is a wonderful anchor for the slave trail. And somewhere on the order of 150 to 250,000 slaves were sold in Richmond slave markets in Chaco Bottom and were sent down through that slave trail that went across to Manchester, where they would board ships to go to the Deep South. That is such a moving, moving concept, because Virginia became an exporter of slaves. And so we have the possibility here to really memorialize something that is astounding, in my opinion, and would be a tremendous draw to the region, because there really are no... Where are the other sites where you can find, still intact, the buildings and the streets that look pretty much as they did 150 years ago, and you can create a slave trail where people can walk that slave trail? The people who are opposed to the stadium are not opposed to development. It's a question of how do we get the best kind of development. And it's true that there are empty buildings in Chaco. There are parking lots at the moment. But it's also true that the city of Richmond has not agreed to sell any land for other uses as long as the stadium was on the plate. So we're kind of caught in a gridlock. When the stadium proponents say this is going to be free to the city, we know that is simply not true. It will be tax revenue that will be used to pay for this. But it gets worse. At the end of 20 to 25 years, when the stadium is all paid for, the stadium then reverts to city ownership. That sounds good, but then you ask yourself the question, what is the useful life of a baseball stadium? And the answer is about 20 to 25 years. So at the end of 20 to 25 years, when the stadium is all used up, essentially, it's then going to belong to the city, and the city will have a white elephant around its neck. And if Richmond continues to grow, as it will, and if the region continues to grow in population, and if the Braves are successful in attracting more people to baseball, then this 7,500-seat stadium, which is a teeny stadium, is going to be too small. And guess what? The Braves in 20 to 25 years are going to be asking around to Chesterfield and Henrico, who wants to build us a big new, brand new big stadium because our stadium is too small. And it could have done another choice. We can do other choices. We can do the kind of heritage historic tourism projects right now that are going to be attractive in 20 years. They're going to be attractive in 40 years or 60 years because nobody else has this kind of history component that we have. And we shouldn't muck it up.
Really appreciate this time you've taken with us and everything you've said.
Thank you very much.
Jonathan White is an economics professor at the University of Richmond. The Richmond Braves declined requests for interviews by WRIR. For WRIR News, I'm George Goodrich. This week, Richmond Renaissance announced plans for Browns Island in October. The National Folk Festival will be in town October 7th through 9th with some of the top names in folk music. Jack Berry, the executive director of Richmond Renaissance, says the folk festival could draw more than 150,000 people to Richmond's riverfront.
It was in Bangor, Maine last year, a community of about 40,000. And surprisingly, they drew 130,000 people. So in Richmond, we've got a million people to deal with, and plus a state, and we'll get tourists from all over the country. So we think this is going to be a really, really huge event. We've got to try to explain to people what a folk festival is, because a lot of people think it's banjos and quilts. And sure, there are going to be some banjos, and there's going to be some great bluegrass. But there'll be all kinds of acts, everything from blues to rockabilly, Caribbean gospel, klezmer, jazz, bluegrass, cowboy, polka, Cajun, tamburica, old time, mariachi, western swing, honky tonk. I mean, it's just everything. Authentic, traditional folk music by artists that learned it from their parents or the guy down the street. Not commercial artists, certainly not top 40. Very few artists that you have ever heard of, although there will be some that are pretty widely known, like Cephas and Wiggins, but mostly groups that will surprise you.
And why did Richmond get it? I mean, this is something that's been going around the country, and it's been up in Bangor for a while.
They take this festival around the country, and they go from city to city, and they spend 3 years in each city. So we've got it for 3 years. We competed with cities all across the country. We think Portland was our biggest competition. But they chose Richmond because they wanted to come to the heart of folk music culture. You know, the Appalachians, Tidewater, Virginia has a rich history and a lot of performers. The theme for the crafts portion of the festival will be musical instrument making. And there are a lot of world-class instrument makers in Virginia that we will feature. One is a guy by the name of Wayne Henderson who makes guitars. Eric Clapton just received a guitar from Wayne Henderson. He had to wait 7 years to get it. So we're going to have the best of the best, and Virginia's very rich in these resources.
Are there going to be classes if someone is learning how to play an instrument? Could they come take a class or maybe get into a jam session or something like that?
I think there'll be jam sessions going on all over the festival site. There will be workshops. For example, we could have six different fiddlers from six different kinds of music all playing together and talking about how their fiddling differs from the next guy. So there will be workshops, there will be educational opportunities, but there won't be classes.
What do you think this will bring to Richmond?
We think it's going to bring the whole community together. We think Cambodians that live in Richmond are going to come out to this because they're going to see acts that they are impressed by. The Hispanic community is going to come out for this because we're going to have the best mariachi band in the United States here. African Americans are going to flock to this festival because we're going to have great, you know, jazz or gospel, blues. People that love bluegrass are going to come to this festival. So we think that just all kinds of different people are going to feel like this is their festival. They're going to come out in just really big numbers. And then, of course, there's an economic impact of about $7 million, which is great too, but that's not really why we're doing it. We're doing it because this is an opportunity to really put Richmond on the map as a major musical city.
And where the performance is going to take place?
The festival will be located on Browns Island, along the riverfront, along the Ethel property. So we're going to just take over the entire riverfront. And we'll have about six or seven stages. They'll be going at the same time. And we'll have groups that come up and spend the weekend. And they won't just do one set. They'll play on Friday, and if you like them, you can probably catch them again on a different stage on Saturday.
In the last 2 years, we've had the rainiest summers on record. Are you concerned that this could get washed out, or is this a rain or shine type of deal?
This is a rain or shine kind of deal. We will have tents. If it's a downpour, we're going to just it's going to be a disaster. But now we're hoping for good weather in October. We've actually gone back and checked the weather charts for years and years and think that our chances are pretty decent. There'll be a dance tent that's going to go on all weekend long, and of course the performers will be under tents. So, yeah, come rain or shine.
So how can people get involved with this? How can Richmonders, you know, take part in this?
Well, we need 600 volunteers to pull this thing off. It's that big. We've recruited about 100 so far. So if you're interested in this at all, we've got a job for you. And then there's a big party Saturday night late that'll go on most all night for the volunteers and all the artists. In order to get an invitation to that party, you've got to be a volunteer.
Jack Berry, thank you very much for talking to us.
Hey, great to be here. Thanks a lot.
Jack Berry is the executive director of Richmond Renaissance.
WRIR News is looking for thought-provoking commentary from Richmond residents. You own the airwaves, so grab a microphone and speak your mind. Contact us by email at news@wrir.org.
This has been Richmond Independent Radio News. I'm George Goodrich. I'd like to thank all the volunteers who helped produce this program.
Andrew Larch.
Nancy Lee.
Mike Doolin.
Aaron Hickey.
Lauren Ball.
If you would like to comment on our news programming, suggest stories, or become part of Richmond Independent Radio News, drop us an email, news@wrir.org. This is WRIR, LP 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.